Does America have a safety net? Compared to many other countries, our healthcare and retirement systems are unreliable at best, which means the burden of caring for the vulnerable falls largely on individuals and disproportionately on women, according to Jessica Calarco, author of the new book, Holding It Together, How Women Became America's Safety Net. Jessica is a professor of sociology at the University of Wisconsin, and she joins us now to share five of her big ideas.
Hello, and thanks for listening. I'm Jessica Calarco, a sociologist at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. My research focuses on inequalities in family life and education, and today I'll be sharing five key insights from my latest book, Holding It Together, How Women Became America's Safety Net. Insight 1. The U.S. tries to DIY society by treating women as its invisible glue. Other countries have invested in social safety nets to help people manage risk. They use taxes and regulations, especially on wealthy people and corporations, to protect people from falling into poverty, to give people a leg up in reaching economic opportunities, and to help people live with dignity regardless of how much money they earn. In the U.S., we've tried to DIY society. We've kept taxes low, slashed huge holes in the meager safety net we do have, and told people that if they just make good choices, they wouldn't need government support at all. Now, the problem is that you can't actually DIY society. Forcing people to manage all that risk on their own has left many American families and communities teetering on the edge of collapse. And yet we haven't collapsed because women are holding it together, filling in the gaps in our economy and the gaps in our threadbare safety net. In the U.S., for example, women are disproportionately the default caregivers for children and for the sick and the elderly and the destitute. They're also the ones who fill the lowest paid jobs in our economy, jobs that are too labor intensive to be profitable or highly paid, including jobs in childcare, customer service, and home health care. As I show in the book, this unpaid and underpaid labor helps maintain the illusion of a DIY society by making it seem as though we can get by without a net. All that responsibility, though, is taking a serious toll on women, which brings me to the next key insight from the book. Insight 2. Our DIY society is crushing women and their families and communities as well. Take, for example, the story of a woman I'll call Akari, one of the hundreds of moms who participated in the research that went into this book. Akari and her partner Theo met in college, but they both dropped out when the costs got too high. Theo started his own home maintenance business, which brought in about $30,000 a year, and Akari helped Theo manage the business while also working in retail part-time. That arrangement worked fairly well until their daughter May was born in 2015. They didn't have family or friends who could provide childcare, and they made too much to qualify for subsidies, but not enough to afford the full price of childcare. So Akari became a stay-at-home mom, and a pretty typical one at that. Typical, that is, in the sense that almost 75% of American stay-at-home moms have household incomes less than $50,000 a year. Akari remained a stay-at-home mom until the summer of 2020, when, unfortunately, Theo died suddenly and unexpectedly. Like roughly half of all U.S. adults, Theo didn't have life insurance, and the little they had in savings wasn't enough to keep paying rent. Akari wanted to try to find a job so she and the kids could stay in their apartment, but local childcare centers were all closed because of the pandemic, and most local businesses were laying people off. And so Akari applied for welfare and food stamps and moved herself and the kids into a shelter where they stayed for the next few months before eventually getting a spot in public housing. Relying on public assistance was challenging for Akari emotionally. Akari never knew anyone on welfare, and she felt guilty about relying on what she called other people's tax money. And yet, the maximum Akari could get from welfare was only $288 a month in Indiana. And even with extra support in the form of Medicaid, food stamps, and subsidized housing and childcare, Akari rarely had enough to make ends meet. Meanwhile, and adding insult to injury, Akari's welfare benefits required that she find paid work, even though her benefits would be docked for every dollar that she earned. So Akari took the first job available, a no-benefits, part-time job in retail, which paid less than $10 an hour. Akari ended up adding a second low-wage part-time job in 2021, but she rarely got enough hours to make ends meet. And so she also took a third job at a manufacturing facility, and a few towns away, working 12-hour shifts on Saturdays and Sundays. To make that job work childcare-wise, the kids spend weekends at Theo's sister's house. Because of the commute time, it doesn't make sense for Akari to pick them up and drop them off both days. So they go to their aunt's house on Friday afternoons and don't come home until Monday morning before school. Akari hates that she doesn't get to spend the weekends with her kids, and she can see the toll her absence is taking on them. My daughter, Akari told me, has PTSD because of her father's death. She went from having a dad who works and being a daddy's girl and having a stay-at-home mom who always cared for her, and now there's no dad and mom's always working. So in her mind, she lost both parents. That sacrifice has been devastating for Akari, but it hasn't left her much better off financially because taking a third job pushed her over the benefits cliff. There's not really a nice transition, Akari told me, saying she would be better off in the short term quitting her third job and going back on welfare. Yet Akari knew the clock was ticking. Indiana's lifetime cap on welfare eligibility is 2 years for adults and 5 years for kids, though soft diversion tactics ensure that almost no one stays in the system that long. She told me, "Welfare's not going to last forever, and I'm just going to get older. Right now I can work, but what am I going to do when I'm 60, you know? I can't have anything saved up if I'm on welfare. You can't move up. You have to stay within that line. Right now where I'm at, I lost all my welfare services, but if I continue to work, eventually I can maybe get a raise." Akari's story raises questions about why the U.S. hasn't invested in building a stronger and less punitive social safety net, which brings us to insight number three. Insight three. The DIY illusion benefits billionaires and big corporations. As I explain in the book, the roots of our DIY society stretch back to the 1930s and to the efforts of business elites to challenge Franklin Roosevelt's New Deal. At the time, the members of the National Association of Manufacturers didn't want to have to pay the higher taxes that would be required to fund large-scale government programs. And so they began looking for a way to persuade people that the U.S. didn't actually need a social safety net. What they found was a group of Austrian economists who were developing a set of neoliberal economic theories. These economists argue that societies will actually be better off without strong social safety nets, because in the absence of government protection, people will be more inclined to make the so-called good choices needed to keep themselves safe. Now, this theory has been thoroughly debunked by evidence. But at the time, and for the members of the National Association of Manufacturers, it had an alluring appeal. And so those corporate elites paid American universities to hire the Austrian economists who developed neoliberalism and to train the next generation of economists and policymakers and business leaders in the U.S. Going a step further, those corporate elites also worked with economists like Milton Friedman to bankroll massive propaganda campaigns. Those campaigns included the popular television program General Electric Theater, which was hosted by Ronald Reagan and which glorified the idea of a DIY society, telling uplifting, though fictional, stories of people pulling themselves out of difficult situations simply by working hard and making the right choice. Of course, the reality is that pulling ourselves up by our bootstraps is impossible, which raises questions about why women don't simply refuse to do this work, and which brings us to our fourth key insight from the book. Insight number four. We force women to fill in the gaps by turning motherhood into a trap that leaves them with nowhere to turn and nowhere to hide. In the presence of anti-abortion norms and regulations, anyone who can become pregnant can be easily forced into motherhood. And in the absence of universal childcare and paid family leave, motherhood can often leave women, especially low-income women, with no choice but to stand in for the social safety net. Take, for example, a young woman I'll call Brooke. Home wasn't a happy place for Brooke growing up. Given her upbringing and her parents' volatile relationship, Brooke never wanted to have kids of her own. And then she accidentally got pregnant in college. Brooke and her boyfriend Brendan initially planned to get an abortion, and Brendan's parents even offered to pay. But then Brooke's parents found out, and Brooke's mom persuaded Brooke to get an ultrasound and keep the baby, promising that Brooke and the baby could live at home and that she would help raise the baby so Brooke could finish college. Once her son Carter was born, however, Brooke's parents told her they couldn't afford to pay for both college and childcare. And without childcare, it was hard for Brooke to keep up with her schoolwork. She also couldn't take night classes because she didn't trust her parents to watch Carter. And so Brooke dropped out of college and moved into a women's shelter, since being on her own would make it easier to qualify for a subsidized apartment and for programs like welfare and WIC and subsidized childcare. Since welfare came with work requirements, Brooke also took the first job she could find, a minimum wage job in retail at the same store as her mom. Brooke hated the job, and she complained about it to the director of Carter's childcare center, who saw Brooke's unhappiness as an opportunity. The center, like many, was struggling with staff turnover, so the director begged Brooke to come on board. The job at the center only paid minimum wage, but it came with free childcare, which was costing Brooke nearly as much as rent. Brooke took the job and loved working with kids, but money remained a constant challenge. Even when she got promoted to assistant director of the center, Brooke's salary was only $25,000 a year. Given the precarity of her situation, Brooke thought about trying to go back to college to get a nursing degree, but Brooke just couldn't figure out how to make it work. So she kept working at the childcare center instead. Brooke was still working in that job a few years later when I met her in 2019. By that point, she had met and married her husband Robbie, an auto mechanic, and given birth a second time to their daughter Emma. Yet Brooke still hadn't made any real progress toward finishing her degree. And in fact, Brooke's in-laws were pressuring her to drop out of the workforce and abandon her college plans. They thought it would be best for their new granddaughter to have a stay-at-home mom, even though Brooke's husband was making only $25,000 a year. That pressure toward stay-at-home motherhood brings us to our final key insight, which has to do with why so much of this work falls to women, even when there are men around who could be doing more to help. Insight number 5. The perks of patriarchy keep men from picking up the slack. Over the last 50 years, Americans have become increasingly uncomfortable with overt displays of sexism toward women. And yet what hasn't gone away is what I call the Mars-Venus myth, which is the idea that most women are naturally better suited for caregiving than men are, and that most women are just happier being at home. As I show in the book, that idea allows men to justify leaving most of the domestic labor to the women around them, even when they could take on more of that responsibility themselves. Take, for example, a dad that I call Dennis. Before Dennis and his wife Bethany had kids, Dennis was making $90,000 a year working in IT, and Bethany was working as a social worker, making $30,000 a year. Given their combined income, they could have afforded to pay for full-time childcare. But Dennis persuaded Bethany that it made more sense, in his words, to not spend half of her paycheck finding care. As their kids got older and started elementary school, Bethany started contemplating going back to the workforce. But Dennis wasn't eager for Bethany to go back to working for pay. Having Bethany at home meant that he never had to worry about things like taking the kids to the doctor or staying home on snow days, and he could go to the gym after work without having to worry about who would make dinner or do the laundry or clean the house. And he told me, it's just easier if she takes care of all that. That's part of the perk of her getting to stay home. Now, note here how Dennis justifies the perks that he is getting from patriarchy, implying, by saying that she is getting to stay home, that she should be grateful for the fact that he's making that a possibility or a choice. Dennis also conveyed a similar message to Bethany. Whenever she talked about maybe going back to the workforce, he reminded her how stressed she was, working for so little money as a social worker, and how, at least in his view, she was now so much happier at home. In essence, Dennis, like many men my research team and I talked to, used the Mars and Venus myth to justify leaving women to be the ones to hold it together, rather than stepping up to help carry more of the load. In the book, I trace the origins of myths like the Mars-Venus myth and the myth of meritocracy and the myth of the supermom. I show how those myths delude many Americans into believing that we don't need a social safety net. And I show how those myths also divide us by race and class and gender and politics and even religion in ways that keep us from recognizing how a stronger social safety net would leave the vast majority of us in a less precarious position and would also help us all to contribute more equally and more sustainably to the management of risks in our society and to supporting the shared project of care. Thank you for listening and for your interest in this book. Writing it for me was as much a labor of fury as a labor of love, and I hope it will resonate similarly with you.
Thank you, Jessica. That was Jessica Calarco with 5 Big Ideas from Holding It Together, How Women Became America's Safety Net. I'm Michael Kovnat. Thanks for listening.